Good afternoon, everybody. Please be seated.
This is the final case on today's docket. This is the Northern Panel with Justice Sato on my left, Justice Gibbons on my right. I'm Justice Michael Cherry. This is case number 51835, Peter Justin Pirtle versus State of Nevada. Mr. Erickson? You're on.
May it please the court, I'm Tom Erickson representing Peter Justin Pirtle this afternoon. I want to begin, hopefully, to set the stage with a short quote from the Abbott case that I think is very critical in the evaluation in this matter. Quote, sex crimes against children are extremely upsetting, and our legislature placed a very severe punishment to fit that crime. As such, it is vitally important that if this penalty is imposed, it is imposed only on a defendant deserving of the punishment. This can only be assured where the defendant is given a meaningful opportunity to present his defense. As you're aware, our appeal is based on what we believe is a fundamental lack of an opportunity for Justin Pirtle to present a full and fair defense at his trial. He has been convicted of multiple crimes. He's now serving 40 years to life on that conviction. Unless there are particular areas you want me to go into initially, I will just quickly go through some of the relevant facts to set the stage for the legal argument. There were allegations that he had molested three different children. The first is Sierra Pirtle. She, time and time and time again, denied that there was any inappropriate conduct with Justin whatsoever. As indicated in the record, there was an investigation done in New Mexico on that, and the findings were unsubstantiated. Nonetheless, charges were brought here. The other two children are Dallas Watts, and there are some important factual instances where Dallas's credibility is definitely in question. He admitted that he had talked to Starla about allegations, and Starla is the third of the alleged victims, that he had talked to her about Justin and allegations against Justin. He testified that his mother had told him that Justin had raped Sierra and blamed somebody else for that rape. He testified that he did not come forward earlier with his allegations because, quote, he didn't remember them, unquote. And then his story changed substantially. Through all of the interview process with the state and the detectives, and up until he was on the stand at trial, he had said that he had been molested one time by Justin. At trial, he, out of the blue, says that he had been molested three times. And we have the huge issue with him of him claiming that he was molested between the ages of 2 and 4. With Starla, it is significant to understand the relationship. She was Justin's stepdaughter. The other alleged victim, female, was Sierra, Justin's natural daughter. At the time that Starla came forward with these allegations, which was several years after Justin had left the residence, and at a time where a custody dispute was involved concerning a third younger sister, I believe her name is Shyla. Starla was aware that Justin had gotten custody of Sierra. And we have this dispute, custody dispute between Justin and Starla's mother related to her younger daughter, Shyla. She alleges that during a 3 to 4 year period, she was sexually assaulted. She initially said every day. Later, it was pointed out to her that she wasn't home every day. She was on weekends at a different location. She said, well, it wasn't on those days. But sexually assaulted nearly every day for 3 to 4 years in a household of 8 to 9 people living in a small apartment. She testified that most of the sexual assaults took place out on the little apartment balcony while the rest of the family was sleeping. There were no physical findings of any evidence of sexual assault, despite her claims of 3 to 4 years of being violated. And as outlined in the briefs, multiple inconsistencies in her testimony. Now, the two issues are whether or not Dr. Chambers was inappropriately limited into what he could testify to. And I won't quote from NRS 50275, but that is the statute related to the testimony of experts. It's our position that the trial judge incorrectly limited what Dr. Chambers could testify to, and I want to specifically go through some of those limitations. Dr. Chambers was going to testify regarding memory creation and formation in young children, specifically 3 to 4 year olds, as that was originally when Dallas claims that he was assaulted and the time frame. And the trial judge indicated that Dr. Chambers could not, but when regarding the age issues, and I'm quoting now, the judge said, "Now he's starting to talk basically his opinions on the efficacy of the kids. Scientific studies verifying false accusations. He can't testify to that." That, again, that's just his recitation of somebody else's opinion about the veracity of kids. And he goes on to indicate that Dr. Chambers cannot testify related to the effects of age on memory formation and recall. He was also not allowed to testify to studies related to false allegations of sexual assault in the scientific literature. Dr. Chambers was never going to testify regarding the truthfulness of any of the children testifying in that trial. He was going to testify to the scientific findings related to that area of inquiry.
Now, Mr. Erickson, let me ask you this. Assuming we agreed with your argument, the judge should have allowed that testimony, tell us why it wasn't harmless error to prohibit Dr. Chambers from submitting that testimony to the jury.
Your Honor, I think this area is just so critical because of the layperson, lay attorney's opinion that they understand memory. We all have memories. We think that we know how it works when we were kids, and that simply is not generally accurate. And Dr. Chambers was going to be able to educate the jury as to how recall, how formulation of memories comes about in small children. And because of most people's feelings that they know that, that makes it all the more dangerous in this case because we were not able to present the scientific evidence out there in the literature in this area. And I believe that is why it was not harmless.
Well, let me ask you, to go to that point, maybe we're jumping around a little bit, and I apologize for doing that, but one of the victims was, or alleged victims, is Dallas, and it's alleged that Dallas bit Mr. Pirtle's penis and that there was bite marks on it, that Mr. Pirtle's wife saw the marks on his penis, and that Dallas told Steve, I guess his sister-in-law's boyfriend, I believe, that he got the marks on his penis from slamming his penis into a car door, then like that. Now, isn't that corroborating testimony that a sexual assault occurred? And couldn't the jury conclude that maybe that story is incredible about getting it on a car door slamming on your penis, getting bite marks on it? And so there's independent evidence to corroborate at least that particular situation, and what seemed to me would lead me to conclude it may be harmless, at least as to this victim in this situation.
Your Honor, the issue as to the car door and things of that was something that, and this is in the trial record, they had originally said that he had been taken to the hospital because of had been treated medically for the penis injury. We subpoenaed every medical provider in the Las Vegas area for records on that. When we got all of those back, everyone saying no, it was stipulated, and it's in the record, that he was never even seen for this injury that the ex-wife, who he is in this bitter dispute, custody dispute with, is claiming that she had seen bite marks.
What about the comment from Steve that Mr. Pirtle allegedly told him about he hurt his penis by slamming it into the car door? Is he saying that's fabricated?
Your Honor, that certainly is our position, because when we had the opportunity to try to prove a negative that there was never even any treatment, they said he had gone and was medically treated for this. It was stipulated, no, that didn't happen. And again, this defendant is in the position of trying to prove a negative, which is always a very difficult, supposedly he doesn't have any burden, but reality is.
But the jury can sit there and weigh this testimony and weigh the credibility of these witnesses that testify and determine if they believe them or not. So isn't it their call as opposed to ours right now at this stage?
Your Honor, it is our position that it is definitely the juror's call when they are given all of the information to be able to properly evaluate this testimony. When Dr. Chambers is not able to testify regarding a child who gets up there and says he remembers when he was 2 years old being sexually assaulted for the first time that any of us had heard that it was a second or third assault, that is critical credibility information that jurors, they do not have the information to process that fully, is our position.
I understand.
You also raised another issue, and I kind of want to move you into it because it's of significance to me, and that is you sought presumably a psychological evaluation of some of these witnesses. That's an issue that's important for my consideration of this matter.
And Your Honor, I will jump to that. I think it's very important to begin with the state's position that they did not elicit psychological type of testimony in this trial.
The threshold, in other words. In order for you to seek the evaluation, they would have to have used an expert and received some benefit from that testimony, and the other two prongs that I presume you're going to get to.
Correct. And as you're very likely aware, in the Abbott case, and I'm quoting from page 727 of that opinion, we have previously stated that a person need not be a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist in order for their testimony to constitute that of an expert. Where a state's expert testifies concerning behavioral patterns and responses associated with with victims of child sexual abuse, courts have recognized that this type of testimony puts the child's behavior and psychological characteristics at issue. And there was talking about an investigating detective. From the state's response, I want to quote from what Dr. Maida and the detective testified to on Dr. Maida, and this was after me trying to cross-examine on all these inconsistencies, and the state then on redirect elicits this type of testimony. Lastly, Dr. Maida told the jury that delayed reporting of the abuse is the norm, and that people who seriously molest children manipulate them in different ways to prevent them from disclosing the abuse.
Was there an objection to that?
I don't know if directly at that point if there was.
Was there a motion to strike?
I believe that, Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that at this point. But in finalizing the arguments here and seeing the I think that the overall totality, based on the requirement as listed in Abbott, that, quote, if the state intends that an investigator will testify beyond the facts of the case and will provide his own experiences and assessment of the interview, the state must notify the district court prior to trial so as to afford the defendant time to request his own independent psychological evaluation. None of that was done. It was obviously on the fly in the heat of a trial, and we would argue that the fundamental unfairness of this coming out. So that was Dr. Mehta on redirect.
Dr. Mehta, though, wasn't she basically providing medical testimony, though? That was the thrust of it?
Yes, Your Honor. That's what she was called for. Mm-hmm. Then she, after all of the inconsistencies were brought out, she testifies to this.
You're out of time. I'm going to give you 2 additional minutes for rebuttal, but I'm going to give Ms. Clark 17 minutes. Give you the extra 2 minutes now, Ms. Clark. And you'll have 2 minutes on rebuttal.
Actually, Your Honor, I think I reserved 3, so I think that I still have...
No, what happened, Harriet?
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, thank you.
Ms. Clark, you have 17 minutes. I'm giving you 2 extra minutes, so you can use it if you need to. And then Mr. Erickson will have 2 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the Court. My name is Summer Clark. I'm here on behalf of the Deputy District Attorney's Office. I'm here in the District Attorney's Office representing the state of Nevada. I'd like to first point out a few of the mistakes in terms of the recitation of the facts. Mr. Erickson brought up the brewing custody battle. I'd like to make sure that you are aware that that evidence was only brought out by one witness, and that was the defendant himself. There was no other evidence that there was a brewing custody battle between Starla and the defendant.
But he did so in order to establish that there may have been some motive for the children to lie, or that their testimony may have been something other than what the jury was hearing, had there not been this battle.
Correct. However, I think it's important because in almost every instance where the appellant cites the inconsistencies, he blames those inconsistencies on coaching or bias and then relates back to the brewing custody battle. So I just think it's important to note that that wasn't, other than the defendant's testimony, there was no other evidence to that. The other thing I'd like to note is the delayed disclosure that was just brought up recently. That was actually not a question from the state. That was a question from the juror. There was no objection and no motion to strike. Furthermore, according to Smith v. State, an expert is allowed to discuss why a child might delay in their disclosure of sexual abuse.
Which leads me to my question. Why then shouldn't Dr. Chambers have been allowed to testify? Why was that testimony limited?
Actually, Dr. Chambers was able to testify about memories. I know Mr. Erickson focused most of his argument up here on memories versus the false allegations. He submitted 13 things he wanted to bring up in his motion to admit that testimony, and 8 of those things were allowed. Those all had to do with memories and formations in children. Specifically, he testified that there are no true or reliable memories prior to age 4 or 5. That right there addresses Mr. Erickson's concern that, well, this child was 2, 3, or 4, how could he possibly remember? He also testified that our memory of events can be improperly remembered when they're influenced by other things, like people telling us things. That was
or a bitter custody battle.
Or a bitter custody battle, but the point is, Dr. Chambers was allowed to testify about those, and he did. The state interjected, and we objected to those statements. However, that still was evidence that was presented to the jury. So the limiting of that testimony certainly was not improper. And finally, in regard to that, even if his testimony wasn't properly limited, it was harmless error because there was corroboration, and it wasn't just corroboration with Dallas and the bite marks on the penis. There was also corroboration with Starla, and it wasn't similar preceding events. The events that were corroborated had to do with the sexual assault. So during the instance...
What was the corroboration?
The corroboration was both Starla testified that the defendant made her and the sisters keep their shoes under the bed so that when he sexually assaulted them, they couldn't run away. Crystal, her mother, testified that one day she was working, the daughter came across the desert without shoes on in her nightgown to see her. Starla said the same thing, and she testified that when her mother drove her back and dropped her off at the apartment, the abuse continued. Furthermore, Starla testified that there was one instance during the abuse when he was yelling at her and they heard the mother come home, Crystal. So she and the defendant went into the bathroom, and it was the day she was wearing overalls. And Crystal testified at trial that there was a time she came home from work early, she walked in the bathroom, and she saw the defendant yelling at Starla and asked her why he was doing that. We also have bleeding that Starla said she found, and Crystal confirmed that. We also have Crystal's testimony that Starla often complained of pain in her vagina. And as Starla testified, there was pain in her vagina and her anus because of the sexual abuse. So there was ample corroboration in this case in addition to the bite marks, not to mention the fact that Sierra Pirtle, her being the biological daughter of the defendant, her denying that these instances occurred doesn't contradict the other two's testimony. There are many reasons why it doesn't. She's the biological daughter of the defendant. When these charges were first brought forward, she was still living in New Mexico with the defendant and the defendant's fiancé. And even after the defendant was arrested, she lived with Tara Hawthorne, who was the defendant's fiancé and was in constant contact with the defendant on a daily basis while he was in jail.
I have five questions for you. Why was Dr. Chambers prohibited from testifying regarding the scientific studies verifying false accusations of sexual abuse by children?
The state argued that the scientific studies that he was not allowed to bring up were not relevant in the sense that by discussing the studies of false allegations, you're essentially discussing how these allegations are false. By describing the instances of what children do or how you can spot a false accusation, for example.
And isn't that precisely the information that jurors who are otherwise uneducated in this area need to hear? Not necessarily that there are false accusations in this case, but that scientific studies have proven in certain instances, here's how you identify a false accusation.
Well, the state submits that they did receive that, and that was done based on the cross-examination of Mr. Erickson by Detective Rates that was on the stand, as well as Dr. Mehta.
But not by and through an expert witness?
Not by an expert witness in that regard, no. And that's because of the qualifications of Dr. Chambers. He went through all of the instances of essentially false allegations, but without exactly describing it. In fact, the state brought the motion in limine to exclude or limit his testimony because the defense didn't even bring it up. However, we wanted to make sure that we addressed the issue outside the presence of the jury in this case. And he was allowed to testify at length.
What about how a child's belief that someone is bad or dangerous or otherwise undesirable can lead to a child rationalizing the creation of false allegations against the person?
And again, my answer would be the same to the false allegations, is that Dr. Chambers' experience was specifically in regard to memories, the sleep disorder that he ran a sleep disorder clinic and so forth. In terms of the false allegations, we actually did get into some of the research, and he was unable on a cross-examination to tell me what the articles were, who the research was conducted by, how many people were in that research, etc., other than to stand up and say, these are the false allegations, and here's what kids do when they receive false allegations.
What about published literature on the characteristics of false abuse allegations made in the context of a custody dispute?
Again, Judge, that's the state's position before, and it is now, that was the defense's backdoor way of getting in to the jury. Hint, hint, Starla and Dallas, and they are making these things up. These are false allegations. It's commenting on the veracity of a witness, and again, under Gaxiola, that's not appropriate. It wasn't specifically on false allegations in the custody battle because Mr. Erickson argued that. He stood up in closing and said, look, there was a brewing custody battle. These are false allegations. You heard Dr. Chambers testify that kids can't have memories prior to 4 or 5 years old, so Dallas is not being truthful. Essentially, any evidence that the jury would have gathered from Dr. Chambers' testimony regarding false allegations already came out and was argued by Mr. Erickson, and they didn't find it persuasive, which is why they found him guilty of all the counts.
What about psychological literature on memory errors and other common signs indicative of a false report by children?
Dr. Chambers touched on that issue toward the end of his examination. Specifically, he testified about memories in children and how kids will often not remember an event the way it happened because of outside factors that influence that memory. And I think that's sort of what that goes to. So he was allowed to go into that. Despite the state's objections, the jury did hear that evidence, which is, again, coupled with the corroboration, is harmless error.
And what about signs which indicate that a child's report may have been enhanced by contact with adults?
And again, I would cite to exactly what I had just said, which is Dr. Chambers did testify that memories of kids are often affected by what adults tell them. And Dr. Chambers specifically mentioned that and said, the events that you remember are going to change based on outside influence.
Now I'm going to ask you to put your harmless error hat on. And let's say that we do find this to be error, at least one of the five things that I've just gone over with you. Why is it harmless in this particular case? Tell me about whether the evidence is overwhelming, close, whatever, if you would, Ms. Clark.
State submits that the evidence in this case is overwhelming, and the reason for this is such. I mentioned the corroboration regarding running across the parking lot, overalls, and the bleeding and so forth and the pain. The bite mark in the penis is also very a very important thing. The state and the defense stipulated that the defendant wasn't seen at a hospital. We never stipulated that he wasn't bit by Dallas. And in fact, Dallas actually described on the stand, an 8-year-old little boy, that his jaw hurt after this incident of fellatio with the defendant. And the state argued, what 8-year-old little boy is going to know to say, my jaw hurt afterward? Furthermore, when Dr. Mehta testified, it's important to note, she did note a superficial notch that was there. She said that she's not sure if it was there at the time of birth or if it was something else, but it is worth mentioning that she didn't just find a straight, normal exam. She found a nonspecific finding. So even though she couldn't make a conclusory opinion about it, it was still there. In addition to that, we have more than one victim. I think the important thing to note is Starla did not come forward on her own. Dallas was talking to his mom and her fiancé after he had had a conversation with some school friends of his about homosexuality, and I think he said some gay kids, and the memory popped into his head of this fellatio incident between the defendant. Only when Melissa, Dallas's mom, called Starla and talked to her, she said, did anything ever happen to you? And Starla said, she said, I didn't think anybody knew. And then when Melissa said, you're not the only one, Starla didn't say, oh yeah, it was Dallas and we've talked about it. She said, oh, Sierra, how did you know about Sierra? These are three kids who didn't talk about the abuse, who didn't disclose the abuse afterwards. And it wasn't like you had three kids playing in a room and they all come out at the same time and say, hey, guess what? The defendant touched me. That's not how this came out at all. So I think all of those things combined show that there is corroboration and there is, it may not be overwhelming in the sense that we don't have physical findings, but that's the exact reason why we have the law in the state that says, the victim's statement alone, it can be believed is enough if proved beyond a reasonable doubt.
Go ahead with your argument.
And if I may address briefly the independent psychological evaluation, the state did not call or obtain any benefit from an expert. Detective Raitt did not ask the questions that Detective Ettinger did in Abbott. Detective Ettinger was specifically asked, did you form conclusions about this child and what did you do to ensure fairness? Oh, it was a fair interview, he said. He testified that he asked the child about whether or not he had fun with the defendant and then went on to explain to the jury that, well, kids who have fun with somebody obviously wouldn't have a bias or a motive to lie. And then went further to say, no, I don't believe this child in coach bias. Detective Raitt said nothing of the sort. So the state submits that clinical forensic interviewer under Abbott is not an expert. Dr. Mehta, also not an expert. She was a medical doctor, so a medical expert, but not a psychological expert. She did not make any findings other than physical abuse. The appellant in his reply brief said that she said based on sociological reasons she may have found abuse, and the state cannot find anywhere in the transcript where it says that. The mere fact that she strongly recommended counseling to the victim is not enough to show there may have been abuse or not, certainly not enough to show there should be an independent psychological evaluation, because following the appellant's logic, that means any time that counseling is recommended to a patient or to someone who comes in for a sex abuse kit, that person then must submit to an independent psychological evaluation or at least a factor to be considered. The other factor is whether evidence supported by literal or no corroboration, and I've already gone over what we believe is the corroboration in this case. And finally, under Kirshner, the last factor of a compelling need is whether or not there's a reasonable basis to believe the victim suffered emotional or mental state may have affected her veracity. The defense failed to show that both previously, and the appellant has failed to show that now. In Abbott, I think it's important to note that the court based their reasonable basis on the fact that this child had been exposed to a lot of sexual behavior. She had seen her father and his exotic dancer girlfriend showering together. She asked her mom why she and Abbott couldn't shower together. She had engaged in own sexual behavior of herself. She inserted styrofoam balls and erasers into her vagina. She pole danced. She had made previous false allegations, more than four, one against her father, one against Abbott, and three against school kids that she had been with and that she had been around. So it wasn't that when the court found that there was a reasonable basis to believe she had an altered state that affected her veracity, it was based on all of those, the prior false allegations, the sexual behavior of herself, and the observed sexual behavior. We have nothing of that in this case. No one ever testified that there was any exposure to sexual behavior, any sexual acts, nothing. So under Kirshner and looking through Abbott, they haven't met those three factors. They haven't met the compelling need, and the court has to look at all three of those together. Even so, looking at them together, they don't present a compelling need, and he certainly didn't meet that burden as it is his burden, as we have required in Abbott and in Kirshner. And unless...
Justice Haddie, do you have any other questions?
I do not.
Justice Gibbons? Ms. Clark, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Erickson, you have 2 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to hit a couple of the real important things, I think, here. One, the question as to harmless error, where we have a young lady claiming 3 to 4 years of sexual abuse or almost daily, no physical findings whatsoever, all of the other inconsistencies that are outlined, and then the testimony that came out from Dr. Maida about reasons why there are delays in reporting things of that nature, as well as from on redirect from Detective Rates, testified that it was common for kids to disclose abuse years after it happened, and it was also common for kids to remember more details about prior abuse after he interviewed them. In this case, where the court hamstringed our ability to have Dr. Chambers explain psychologically issues related to credibility, not testifying as to the credibility of these children, but overall, it was very easy for the state to attack him on cross-examination because he wasn't able to go into, this just isn't my opinion, there are scientific study after study that shows this and this that he could go into. He did not have that to substantiate or help inform the jury so they could properly evaluate this. This case was a very, very close case. As, and I believe this is part of the record, this is the transcript from the sentencing, and this is when the jury was first asked after the conviction what their initial vote was. It was 8 for not guilty, 4 for guilty was the initial poll of that jury. This was a very, very close case.
Who brought that up at the sentencing? The judge or what?
No, I was the one that brought that up to the judge as part of the...
Okay.
There was not harmless error here. This was a case where had the jurors been fully informed by Dr. Chambers and had that psychological evaluation of those children been done, Mr. Pirtle would have been able to present a full defense and he would have had a fair trial, and that didn't happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Thank you, Ms. Clark. Both of you did a fine job of arguing this case, and the briefs were very sufficient in this matter. This matter will stand submitted. Good seeing you all.
Thank you.